Dr. Zelig will see you now.
I wonder if you could help me with a problem.
Certainly try. We can't promise anything.
You see, last week I was with a group of fairly erudite people who were discussing the novel Moby Dick. And I was afraid to admit that I hadn't read it, so I lied. You see, I want so badly to be liked, to be like other people, so that I don't stand out.
That's natural.
Living in the dark secret of books you haven't read, lying to impress your friends and to feel educated. Who does that? Got me. You know, I think James Joyce's Ulysses really picks up where Moby Dick leaves off. I really do. The Great White Lie on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 9th. I'm just Captain Ahab here on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I am Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who is on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, if you take a bus or subway to get around, the president's transit plans will impact you, will tell you what to watch for. Also look at India pointing the way to what's next for the rocky global economy. Those stories and more ahead, but first these headlines.
President Obama's auto task force is in Detroit today. They'll meet with car execs and union leaders. They want more details on what automakers plan to do with the nearly $40 billion in government loans GM and Chrysler want. John Boehner weighed in.
It's an important institution in our country. It impacts hundreds of thousands of jobs. But they have to do the serious work that they've avoided doing over the last 30 years if they're going to survive.
Congressman John Boehner, Republican, speaking on CBS. Ford doesn't have its hands out for government money so far, but it is asking for help from the United Auto Workers Union. Today, a UAW member vote on a new deal could include pay freeze and a loss of some job protection.
President Obama will reverse a Bush administration ban on embryonic stem cell research funding this morning. It's just one item on this week's agenda. We are going to bring you that and more stories to watch this week, as we do every Monday in a conversation coming up. Gas prices are also coming up, rising, that is. Average national gas prices are $1.96 a gallon, up nearly 2 cents. That's not much, but oil analyst Trilby Lundberg says there's more to come.
Slightly higher crude oil prices and slightly higher gasoline demand over last year have bumped up the price a little bit. They're about to do it even more as we enter the spring driving season.
And Lundberg's firm conducts the national survey.
Oil's trading about $46 a barrel this morning. That's up because of an OPEC expected production cut. Circuit City gone for good. Electronics retailer shut its doors Sunday. 34,000 employees out of work. Dow and S&P posted tiny gains on Friday. The S&P starts trading at 683. Dow and S&P futures point to a lower opening. New lows will be tested at least this morning when the markets open. So we are serious. What books do you lie about? That's right. You didn't read them. Important books like Ulysses. Do you dare lie about, say, Toni Morrison's Beloved? Patrick Henry Bass will be here assembling a list of books people lie about. Surprise, the Bible's on the list. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and sitting in for Adora Udoji is Farai Chidea.
Hello.
All right. It's time for...
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
On Monday morning, our agenda segment attempts to look forward into the week and see what tests you should actually be looking for policy in the Obama administration and other breaking stories around the world. And joining us is Marcus Mabry, international business editor from the New York Times. He's in the studio. And, of course, our pal Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection in Washington. Todd and Marcus, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So, Marcus, is it fair to say that with all of the big, huge announcements of policy initiatives pretty much out the door, we've got one this morning that we'll talk about in a minute, that this week is about focusing smaller details, aspects of the Obama program, that that's really what we're looking for in the days ahead?
I think there'll be a lot of that, including on the issue we'll talk about in a little while about the announcement we made today. But also, I think there'll also be this issue of looking inside policy and some would argue the lack of policy when it comes to things like the financial industry bailout, for instance. You know, what's being productive, what's not being productive, what details still left to be brought out by the administration.
So increased focus on the program and perhaps more accountability and a discussion of deficits and omissions this week as we go forward. We have an announcement out of the White House this morning that involves science and politics. Todd, can you explain?
Yes. Well, about 11:45, I think this morning, the president's scheduled to have an event, sign an executive order reversing the August 2001 George W. Bush policy on embryonic stem cell research. That policy, it wasn't quite a ban on embryonic stem cell research. In fact, it wasn't a ban at all. What it did was restrict federal funding to embryonic stem cell research on stem cell lines that were already created at the time. The way to think about that is you take an embryo, the embryo has to be destroyed in order to harvest the stem cells. That ruling said that an executive order said that stem cell research federal funding can only be used for ones that were already created. There were about 22 lines. That's not very much. They need thousands to do the research. It's a campaign promise. Obama will reverse that and open the door to hundreds of millions, if not $1 or $2 billion, probably a little bit less than that, but hundreds of millions of dollars in NIH funding for research. It'll take him a few months to get that up and running, right? Because NIH also has to set down the ethical guidelines for people to apply for the grants and get the stem cells, and most importantly, informed consent from couples who undergo IVF, in vitro fertilization. That's mm-hmm. where most of the embryos come from. So they have to have ethical guidelines to make sure that everybody can donate those properly.
Todd, one thing that definitely intrigued me was there's going to be a whole sort of revision of how the administration looks at science, but we'll talk about that more later. I want to ask you about something completely different, which is the spending bill on Thursday. The Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, wasn't able to hit 60 votes and pass the spending bill. Apparently, profanity was invoked in the Capitol. Never happened before.
Right, never.
Well, you know, let me ask both of you. I'll start with you. Just quickly, what do you see ahead? And I want to get Marcus in on that as well.
Yeah, well, starting tonight, they're going to continue voting on a whole big list of amendments. The reason that deal fell apart was a lot of different senators have a lot of different priorities. One of those is what's called regular order. We want votes on our amendments or else we're not going to cut off debate. That's what happened on Thursday. So starting tonight at 5:30, there's a list of at least a dozen or 14 or 16 amendments that'll still be voted on, everything from D.C. school vouchers to Gaza to congressional pay raises. Democrats are in a bit of a box over their own pay raises next year. That's going to be an interesting vote. Lots of those. They hope to pass this probably by Tuesday. They probably get it done once they get these amendments processed.
And can you contextualize this, Marcus, just a little bit in terms of partisan politics and whether or not they're heating up?
Sure. What we're looking at here is this is an omnibus bill, looking at all this, the unfinished business really left over from the Bush administration, the spending bills that still have to be passed. And as Todd was saying, all these amendments were stacked on really kind of as an impediment, kind of as roadblocks. If the Democrats cannot get past these impediments, and I think they will. I think they'll vote on the bill. I think it will pass this week. They have few other options. They had to pass an emergency, continuation bill just to keep the government running since they hadn't passed this bill last week. If the Democrats cannot get this back online and get across these kind of political obstacles that the Republicans are throwing up, definitely, in partisan, with partisan means, partisan ends in mind, and then the Democrats are going to look like they're ineffectual. And I think that's the real danger of this week writ large. The danger is that the Obama administration, the Democratic leadership in Congress, may start to take some hard hits, not just from the Republicans, which is to be expected, but from outside observers start to say, look at these unemployment numbers we saw last week, extraordinary
right.
historic numbers. They're going to say, look at the lack of political leadership and ability for the Democrats to get their own agenda through.
The markets are saying that this morning. I mean, it looks like the Dow and S&P are poised to test new lows today. But, you know, so what we need to look for this week in the politics about the spending bill is, does the Democratic Party move forward the wheels of government, or do the Republicans and the critics slow it down to the point where this becomes Obama's recession?
That's exactly right. That's
let me change then and shift gears. I mean, in macroeconomic terms, whatever is decided in Washington, this may be China's recession, in the sense that growth in China or lack of growth in China could be the sort of engine stall that's hurting all of us.
Well, you know, it's kind of extraordinary, John, if we look at it. China has taken on such a role in this global economy. Let's remember, we're talking about a global capitalist economy. The international economy is capitalist. Communism lost that battle, right? So we're in a capitalist system. And yet, one of the most important countries, and as you suggest, perhaps the most important country in getting the global system back up and running again, and out of what looks like it's going to be a global downturn at this point, is China, a communist nation. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary, and it's a really ironic place that China is playing. What we also saw last week, unfortunately, was that it's not a role that China is really comfortable with. It is a role that, you know, we had a former Statistics Bureau chief in China say that the president of China would announce that there would, in fact, be an additional stimulus package to the more than half a trillion dollars they're already going to use to stimulate their economy. And the president didn't do that, and so then the markets tanked. The markets rose in the expectation, tanked in the fact that there was not further stimulus in China. It shows the central importance of that economy now to this global capitalist system.
So just to sum up, I mean, what people need to take from this is uncertainty in Washington, uncertainty in China, the two most important economic players. That's going to lead to more uncertainty going forward.
And not to mention uncertainty in the EU, which is the third one, and uncertainty in Japan, the fourth one.
All right, Todd, I'm going to come back to you. There's so many different things that are happening in the free-for-all right now. There's also a battle over union organizing, and it could lead to some radical changes in labor law. What exactly does a card check mean? And just take us forward into what's going on.
A card check is one of these classic ideological pivot point wedges between Republicans and Democrats. Union elections in companies can either be secret or they can be public, meaning your ballot, whether you choose to join the union or exit the union, can either be secret or open for all to see. And that therein lies the idea of the card check, who's checking your card. There is a hearing in the Senate this week on card check, and that the card check rule has been a strong wedge between Republicans and Democrats. You can imagine that Republicans, who tend to stand up for business, want those union elections to be open. They want everyone to be able to see how you're voting. Democrats would prefer what the unions prefer. The SEIU, the AFL-CIO, and UAW, the big unions, want to be able to unionize shops more easily. And if those are closed ballots, it's easier to do that. And that's going to be a huge, huge wedge.
Well, it's a test it's a huge test of union clout after the campaign, where the unions were really a big part of this campaign. Before we go, Todd, I want you both to listen to this. This is some tape of President Obama talking to New York Times reporters on Air Force One last Friday, and it really sort of tees up an issue that I think is also important to be focused in the developments this week. First, listen to Obama.
At the heart of a new Afghanistan policy is going to be a smarter Pakistan policy. As long as you've got safe havens in these border regions that the Pakistani government can't control or reach in effective ways, you know, we're going to continue to see vulnerability on the Afghan side of the border.
Marcus Mabry, what is a smart Pakistan policy, and what little details this week are likely to illuminate what that might be?
Well, you know, this is the tough challenge, and the specter has been raised. I think Newsweek put it on its cover. Will Pakistan be this president's Vietnam? This has got to be central. This region is a central conflict they will deal with in the same way Iraq was for the Bush administration. I don't think they're clear on what exactly the details will be. I think we will see them emerging this week and next week as well. But I think getting it right is the toughest thing that they face right now.
Todd, are there any posturing on Capitol Hill? Just a one-word answer on the Pakistan issue.
Not yet. It's coming.
Not yet, but it's coming. Marcus Mabry, international business editor, New York Times, and Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Thanks to both of you for setting the agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Brian Chidea.
Hello.
And for Adora Udoji. And we are building another reading list. Yes, well, this is a reading list for liars. Books that people always fib about reading. What books have you said you read but haven't really, and why? Julia wrote us in an email. Oh, that's easy. The Bible. Tell us your fibs at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Brian?
Well, you know, I like reading on the subway, but yeah.
I do too.
Do you travel on the subway?
I love the subway. I go all over the place on the subway, but only where there are elevator stations, because that's really the only way I can get in and out of the subway. But, you know, in preparing for this next story, I learned that when you're traveling underground in the New York subway system, you're also tunneling through the financial crisis in ways that I never really understood before.
Yeah, John, it's fascinating. You know, transit systems around the country are facing huge problems. Higher fares, service cuts, layoffs. Governments don't have a lot of bandwidth to help them out, but some are facing increased stress because of what once seemed like a win-win financing scheme. It's called sale-leaseback agreements, and joining us to discuss the problem is Rick Carr, a reporter for Blueprint America. His two-part series begins airing tonight on the NewsHour on public television. Morning.
Good morning.
So yet another phrase that I haven't heard much about, sale-leaseback agreements. What are they and how do they apply to this transit situation?
Okay, let me actually sort of explain it in terms of the radio station that we're sitting in right now. WNYC could, for instance, take all the equipment here, computers, microphones, mixing boards, and sell them to a bank. WNYC would get 5 to 7% of the money back because the bank can do something that the station can't. The station's a nonprofit. It can't write off depreciation on its taxes because it doesn't pay taxes. But the bank can do that, which means it gets to sort of shave down the amount of its profits that are taxed. So the bank technically owns this stuff, gives WNYC a lump of money. NYC gets to keep 5 to 7% of it, put the rest of it into an interest-bearing account, and then use the interest to lease the equipment back from the bank. Supposedly a win-win, right? Except the bank won't get into this deal unless it's insured. And guess who insured these deals? It's AIG.
Lovely. Yeah.
AIG insured the deals, and all AIG had to do was basically stay solvent and maintain a perfect credit rating, which it didn't manage to do. So it put these transit agencies into technical default.
So what you're saying is that AIG, this huge insurer, which the government is having to spend billions of dollars to support, is the insurer, but because the insurer is...
The banks are the owners, right?
Right.
And
I
the
got
banks
it. Okay.
were saying, to, when AIG went bust, look at the fine print in the contract. It says here, if AIG goes bust, you, transit agency, owe me a bunch of money to liquidate the deal.
So the banks had a guaranteed deal because AIG put up the insurance, and now the transit systems are left holding the bag.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Ouch.
Yeah. You're talking $43 million in the case of Washington, D.C.'s Metro. A Belgian bank called KBC came to Washington Metro, said, give us $43 million. You have 7 days to do it. You may wonder, okay, why did they get involved in this stuff in the first place? Deals are risky. It's a big financial gamble, right? Two things. I talked to a woman named Carol Kissel, who is the chief financial officer of D.C. Metro. She said there are basically two things that motivated to do this. One was the fact that they needed the money. Any little bit of extra cash they can get is great for them. The second thing is that the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, said this is a great idea. Here's Carol Kissel.
We run a train, and we need capital in order to put trains on the network. We relied on the federal government, who was positioning these types of transactions as a way to finance some of the urgent capital needs. And most of the transits, signed up for it willingly because it was deemed approved by the federal government.
Free money.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Not so free anymore.
Yeah, comes at a price. I mean, I understand some of the biggest problems are being faced in places like Jersey, St. Louis, where you were, Washington. How are they dealing with it?
Well, there are 31 agencies across the country that have faced this issue. You know, the MTA here in New York seems to have pretty much steered clear of it. Across the country, though, they still owe billions of dollars, the agencies do. St. Louis's debt just got downgraded in part because it's still got these deals on the books.
Wait a minute, the whole city's debt got downgraded?
No, just the transit agency. Just the transit agency. Yeah, the transit agency's debt got downgraded because of this. New Jersey Transit is mum about this. They just say no comment. D.C. went to court, and one of the reasons why is their board of directors got really mad when this bank came to them because the quarter before the bank came and asked for this $43 million, the bank had taken a loss of 900 million euros, more than $1 billion. I talked to a guy named Gordon Linton, who sits on the board of directors there, and this gives you a sense of the anger that they had in D.C. about this.
The bank said, okay, we want a jumbo payment right now, even though you have not missed any payments. You're not in default. There's only a technicality that we can take advantage of at this point. And we're going to use this opportunity because we're having some financial problems ourselves, and we're going to go to whatever extent we can to get money from whatever source that we have an opportunity.
So they just exercised an option, basically.
Yeah, basically. I mean, and this is the thing. Not all of the banks are doing this. Some of the people in the transit world are saying to me, some of our banks have been saying, let's renegotiate, let's work out the deals. Two of the deals that DC Metro had on the books, the banks have renegotiated for the amount that's already there. But some of the banks are being very aggressive, and in fact, they're getting more aggressive. Just last week, I was talking to folks in transit agencies, and they were saying the banks are really starting to pound the doors down.
Well, quickly, before we go, what is this an obstacle to shovel-ready stimulus money coming in to help mass transit, as we've all heard?
It's not an obstacle to that. Basically, what the deal is that's going to go to those projects anyway. It's going to take some of the pressure off the transit agencies.
Well, thanks much. And that's Rick Carr, reporter for Blueprint America, a PBS project, reporting on America's infrastructure crisis. And he's going to have a piece on this topic on the NewsHour.
So we're building a list of books that people always fib about reading.
I tried to read Moby Dick because I was dating a sea captain, and he loved it. I got through maybe chapters and thought, why?
Well, at least you can render blubber now. Tell us what Cliff Notes you own, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. She knows all about whaling. She's got the headlines. Femi, okay.
Oh, I might lie about it. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Average national gas prices rose nearly 2 cents in the latest Lundberg survey. A regular now averages at 1.96 cents a gallon. Oil is up as well, topping $46 a barrel, driven by an anticipated OPEC production cut, and those numbers are well below the summer highs. Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai now says that the fatal car crash that killed his wife was an accident. Some feared foul play because the party of his political rival, Robert Mugabe, has used violence to intimidate opponents in the past. But Tsvangirai is now back at home preparing for his wife's funeral. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Sad story out of Zimbabwe. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yeah, If you're talking about books, yes, people will lie to you. I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who is on maternity leave, and we are building a list of books that people fib about reading. What book have you said that you read, but you really didn't, and why? Maybe you lied about a book you actually have read, like all seven Harry Potters. Tell us your fibs at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Would that be seven lies, or would that be just be one lie about seven books?
It's sort of like Snow White. There's seven dwarves, but it's one movie.
That's right. So Marcus Mabry, international business editor of The New York Times, is back with us, and we're thinking about the global economy. And I think there is one place in the world that both is emblematic of the potential for growth in the 21st century economy and also the potential for extreme social destabilization in the financial crisis that's now sweeping the world, and it's South Asia, it's India. Joining us now is Vikas Bajaj, a Business Day reporter for The New York Times. Vikas, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
And Marcus, of course, is your editor, so I hope this isn't too intimidating for you.
No, he's not my editor yet. He'll be my editor in about 2 weeks.
Well, you're on your way to Mumbai to be a Business Day reporter for the Times, right?
Indeed.
What is the headline story? Is it the potential for growth in India right now, which is actually above China or right around China at this point, at least according to the forecast? Or is it the potential for destabilizing social impacts from the downturn?
I think it's all of the above. India is certainly growing still, but it's not growing at the rate that it was. And there's some sense that it might not grow that fast going forward because of the financial crisis. In India, a lot of people are hopeful that the financial crisis won't impact them. But it's unclear to me and to a lot of people that will play out in such a benign way.
A lot of economic analysts have suggested that the financial crisis really isn't in Asia because the banks aren't in the same sort of pool of bad money that European and U.S. banks and Japanese banks, to a certain extent, got caught up in. How does that work? And you still say that there will be effects.
Yeah. I mean, it might not necessarily be through the financial channel, but it could be through trade, for instance. I mean, India earns a lot of foreign exchange through outsourcing and technology company selling software and services to the West, and so that could be an impact there. In recent years, they have built up their manufacturing base as well. That could be a problem for them.
I want to go to you, Marcus. Give us a little bit more sense of how you choose what to track with a reporter on the ground. This is obviously a new move for you, having someone full-time on the ground from the Times for the business, the international business section that you do. How do you choose what countries get a dedicated reporter?
Well, it's interesting. We have a huge team in India, but we've not had someone in Mumbai, and we certainly haven't had someone with the kind of depth of experience, certainly in the financial sector, but also globally, of Vikas in that position. I think that's really key to who the person is. Vikas is, Indian of origin and internationalist who grew up in Southeast Asia,
Thailand,
and is going back home to place where, he knows some of it in a kind of intimacy level that few reporters will be able to do, but has the kind of financial chops that few reporters have. So it's an extraordinary combination. We're incredibly excited about it. How we parse out what is obviously in tough economic times, incredibly important positions, but also ones that take a great deal of commitment from the Times to fill, is basically, where's the story? And we've increased our Asian reporters, both in South Asia and in East Asia, tremendously over the last, decade, 15 years. And I still see it going more and more in that direction.
You covered markets for the mm-hmm. Times. I imagine there must be a sense of excitement about getting away from the numbers and actually touring, say, the Tata factory, where there's actual economic activity in the auto industry that is growing.
Yeah, no, that'll be a lot of fun. Not to say that I haven't been doing some of that here. I've been spending a lot of time visiting subdivisions across the United States
lately
and doing housing stories. And that's been just fascinating. I mean, in some ways, it'll be hard to leave the sort of burning fire that is Wall Street and go do something that's a little bit removed from it. But I think, India presents so many great opportunities for stories.
Now, you're not in Mumbai yet, but you're certainly in touch with people in South Asia. Mm-hmm. The Indians have a sense that this is their moment, that given the uncertainty right now, out beyond the horizon, that the future belongs to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think Indians have felt that way for the last 5 years. And I think that in the business community and in the economic circles, people have sort of this great expectation for what India could be, but at the same time, they're also very cognizant of the problems and challenges that India still faces. Infrastructure is being sort of probably the most important of those.
Now, the global economy is expected to shrink, and this is according to the World Bank, for the first time since World War II. And global trade may decline to its lowest point in 80 years. What is India's sharp blade edge on those problems? I mean, I suspect that there's a limit to what India can do to insulate itself from those kinds of problems.
Indeed. I mean, the Indians are hopeful that because their economy is much more internally focused, not as reliant on trade, that they'll be able to continue growing at 7% this coming year. I think that's sort of hard to square with what's going on in the world. They were growing at 9%, so to come down to 7% doesn't seem like a huge adjustment.
So I guess it's fair to say that if there's a takeaway here, India differs from China in the sense that its consumers are actually more of a demand engine. They're more buyers than in China, and so they can actually restart their economy probably even more quickly than the Chinese.
That is certainly the thought there.
All right. Well,
that's what they didn't suggest, but I just want to say that I don't believe it.
It is the theory. We'll watch to see if that's the case. It's certainly going to be part of the story that unfolds as you travel to Mumbai. Vikas Bajaj, soon to be Mumbai reporter for The New York Times, and international editor for The New York Times, Marcus Mabry. Thanks so much for coming in. Brian.
And we have been talking about books you say you've read but actually didn't.
And I'm a foreign language teacher and lead my students to believe that the books that we read in class or excerpts of books that we read in class, that I myself, when I read the book, that I actually read it in the foreign language, which is an absolute lie for every single book that I have ever taught in my French or in my Spanish classes.
Ooh.
She got that off her chest.
Yeah. Tell us what Cliff Notes you own at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Okay has got the news.
Thank you very much, Farai. Good morning, all. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Members of the Obama Administration Auto Task Force meet with senior GM and Chrysler executives in Detroit today. And they will also talk to top union leaders in Detroit. Pharmaceutical giant Merck will buy rival Schering Plough for $41 billion. Both companies are based in New Jersey. There will be an IMF meeting in Africa this week, looking at the impact of economic troubles on the continent. Global leaders even, are meeting today in Tanzania. And I should really say happy 50th birthday to Barbie Millicent Roberts.
Who's that?
Barbie.
Barbie, the
blonde
doll.
Blonde hair, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Tall,
I've heard
slim
of her.
Legs.
Yes, indeed.
Well endowed.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Femi. Made of plastic.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
Hanley Ramirez runs. Breaking ball. Strike three called. It's over. The Netherlands beats the Dominican. How about that?
How about that indeed? That's live. Well, not live, but from the World Baseball Classic. Joining us now is Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway tailgater and sports blogger. Jeff, the Netherlands beats the Dominicans. They were favored going in. That was a bit of an upset, wouldn't you say?
Favorite is not even on the same planet as what happened. The combined salaries of the Dominican team in Major League Baseball, $83 million. The team from the Netherlands, $400,000.
Oh, my God. And that's without A-Rod. If A-Rod had been there, it would have been something like, you know, $500 million, right?
Well, over $100 million, right? It's, yeah. It makes the Miracle on Ice look like nothing.
Miracle on Ice. So how has the World Baseball Classic fared so far? That was a very bizarre upset. But you saw Japan beating China late last week. What else?
Well, the big news yesterday was that the Mexicans went out in their home ballpark in Mexico City and got creamed by the Australians, 17-7. It was astonishing. They actually invoked the mercy rule. The Mexicans walked off the field after eight innings because they were down by 10 runs. It was extraordinary. The Classic as a whole has been up and down, some good games, a lot of early spring training type games, and a lot of empty stands for games that don't involve the home teams in the tournament.
Ah, well, that's interesting, although not necessarily unexpected. I guess for me to see the Netherlands beat the Dominicans and the Australians beat the Mexicans, it says for countries around the world, hey, anybody can play baseball. This isn't so hard.
Baseball is all about pitching. You get a good pitcher, he's throwing well. The Netherlands got a couple of guys who threw very well against the Dominican Republic, and anybody can win a game. It's an amazing thing. The other analogy for the Netherlands and the Dominican Republic, it's as if a team from Bronx High went into Yankee Stadium and beat the Yankees. There's no way to quantify the level of an upset that was.
So were there any scouts in the stands looking at the Netherlands team and maybe, you know, learning how to, you know, say hello in Dutch?
I think I can safely say no.
No.
There were no scouts in the stands looking at the Netherlands team.
But if they had decent pitchers, I mean, do any of these people who perform well in the World Baseball Classic have a chance to be looked at by the majors?
Yes, there will be some guys that on the Dutch team that get a second look. There are a couple of guys who are pitching in the low minors, and of course, you know how they play in the low minors this year will impact their careers in a big way. But I think it's safe to say that you will see virtually no impact in Major League Baseball from now on from any of the guys on the Dutch team. It was an amazing, amazing performance.
Well, Jeff Beresford, we have to leave it there. We didn't have time to talk about the fact that Alex Rodriguez is going to actually have hip surgery and not be a part of the Yankees team in the beginning of the season. He expects to lose 9 weeks. We will see about that. Jeff Beresford Howe reporting on the World Baseball Classic, Takeaway Tailgater, and sports blogger. And, of course, what we're doing is assembling another reading list here on the Takeaway.
Books.
That you lie about.
Absolutely.
Is there a book that you would like to disclose that you never read?
Well, you know, a little bit of Proust, you know, the Bible.
The Bible?
Admit. Sorry,
haven't read
I
the
can't.
Whole Bible? Yeah, I'll disclose that. I never lied about that one, though. So your fibs at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Look, you can admit it to me. I mean, you didn't read Ulysses, okay? Come on. You can admit it to me. We'll find out about who lies about what books when we come back after headlines with Femi, okay?
Good morning. All members of the Obama administration's auto task force will take a closer look at GM and Chrysler's plans for viability in Detroit today. The members plan to meet with top company executives and union leaders. The automakers are seeking tens of billions of dollars in additional aid. The task force will determine whether the car companies can get more money. The Obama administration will end limits on embryonic stem cell research funding today. The president will reverse Bush administration limits on federal money for scientists using the cells. Supporters say the research could lead to breakthroughs on diseases like diabetes and Parkinson's. Pharmaceutical giant Merck will buy rival Schering Plough for $41 billion. Both companies are based in New Jersey, and this comes just after Pfizer's $68 billion purchase of Wyeth. The merged company will be known as Merck and unites the makers of popular anti-cholesterol drugs. In international news, the British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, met with soldiers, police and political leaders in Northern Ireland today. This follows the first deadly attack on British forces in more than a decade. A group called the Real IRA claims responsibility for the weekend attack that killed two soldiers. The group is a splinter group from the IRA, which made peace with the UK years ago. Gerry Adams, president of the political wing of the original IRA, condemned the attack. North Korea has its military on full alert, while the US and South Korea do an annual military drill. Pyongyang calls the exercise preparation for an invasion. Tensions have been high in the region lately. The U.S. and South Korea believe North Korea is ready to test fire a long-range missile. North Korea, meanwhile, claims it's planning to launch a satellite, and any attempt to shoot it down would be an act of war. That's a look at big stories making news for you this morning.
Well, we always love to pretend that we are so erudite, but we are now building a list of books that people always fib about reading. What book have you said that you read but haven't really?
I have never lied about reading a book, but I did read War and Peace just so that I could say I had read it, and it took me 6 months. And then I met somebody who read it in 3 weeks. And there wasn't a character in that book that I even liked.
Okay, that's fortitude right there. Tell us your fibs or maybe your stories of triumph over literature that you don't like at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And so World Book Day was celebrated last week in Britain. A poll was put out to go along with the celebration. People were asked if they had ever claimed to read a book when they had not. 65% of respondents said yes, they had.
Well, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's
work.
Oh,
really? I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan, well, have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So, yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh, I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.
Yeah, that's from Annie Hall. Embarrassing. And so now to discuss more, we've got the takeaways. Patrick Henry Bass. He's a senior editor at Essence Magazine, books editor and published author, too. And I should say in full disclosure that Patrick picked my new novel, Kiss the Sky, as the Essence Book Club pick for May.
Whoa.
But I did not lobby for that. It came as a completely, a complete surprise. But we're not talking about
that.
Don't
worry, he hasn't read it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to be a part of the Liars Club this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're talking about, this survey. What did people lie about reading the most?
Well, what would you think? I mean, what would you think would be one of the books that most people would say that they read that they hadn't read?
I would say War and Peace, maybe, based on what we heard from the Spin Box.
Exactly. And remember, this is England, so 1984 by George Orwell.
Really?
I was surprised that Trollope didn't show up.
Or Galsworthy or something.
Yeah, but, it shows that, an inferiority complex is universal. That's what it shows more than anything else, And while we still cannot break away from our Anglophilia, the British also have this, notion of being smarter, by reading the most complicated books of all time, will somehow get them street cred and or sex. Because that was also one of the factors in terms of reading these particular books.
So if you read all of Dickens, you can get
possibly.
Really?
Yeah.
We could make
a
ribald joke about that, but we will choose not to. But I'm just curious, were the men lying for sex or the women or both?
The men were lying for sex.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that whole thing about men fall in love through the eyes, women fall in love through the ears. So I guess if you read Shakespeare's sonnets and all that, or at least you say that you've read Shakespeare's sonnets, it goes away,
Well, one of the things is that, in New York and the publishing world, I find that people lie about books because, you have here that 25% of the people lied about reading Ulysses. I would say that probably 98% of the people in publishing lie about reading Dubliners. They just hadn't read it. I mean, me and myself, I participated in a lie when there was Cynthia Ozick's The Puttermesser Papers, which was a very well-reviewed book. And I felt pressure to tell people that I read the book. Now, this, no offense to Ms. Ozick, it was an amazing book once I read it 4 years later. But I remember going to lunch and people were thinking, oh, the Puttermesser Papers, is this going to get the National Book Award? And I'm like, well, it deserves to get it.
You would actually
participate in that lie. John, I lied about reading your book, actually. Movement Violations. Well,
thanks,
I'm admitting lies now.
Oh, it's getting personal.
Well, no,
but
it's one of these things. My book is one of these books that people need to lie about because it makes them feel so smart if they read my book. Right.
Well, I remember in college, Remembrance of Things Past by Proust. I just basically read, 10 pages and wrote a paper about it.
You wrote a paper?
I had to write
That's beyond lying.
I didn't lie that I read my 10 pages, so that's, I guess, a semi-lie.
I also want John to fess up that he didn't read Cousin Bet in French.
No, I did not.
You did not read Cousin Bet in French,
No,
did
but
you?
I know the last line of Ulysses.
Okay. The
I am, yes, I will, yes, yes, yes.
Oh, awesome. He's lying.
There's probably a few words wrong, but it's close to that.
I didn't read Ulysses, so I don't know. Okay, well, what do people actually enjoy reading? Do we know anything?
Well, one of the things that, well, you have to go to the bestsellers list, and I think that, you know, authors like Stephen King and Sidney Sheldon and Danielle Steel, and yes, I'm a part of the literati, I think that they tell stories extremely well. And, you know, War and Peace is supposedly universal. I don't think that it carries over as well. I think that Danielle Steel will be remembered the next century far right. more than Tolstoy will. It's just that most people in the most people in the academy will not admit that they've read it, but she will have been read by more people than Tolstoy will have been read.
I think someone like Toni Morrison, I get the sense, and tell me if I'm wrong, that her newer books may have sold less than, you know, something
like
Beloved.
Well, she admits that. Toni Morrison says that if her books hadn't been adopted by, you know, universities and schools, that she probably couldn't get published today. She readily admits that. And if Oprah Winfrey hadn't chosen, you know, Beloved as a film, although the film tanked, you know, it did help sales of the book. And if she hadn't chose Paradise as one of her book club picks, I don't think that Toni Morrison's books would have sold. And remember, The Bluest Eye, when it was first published, was a monumental flop. Most of those books by African-American female writers were largely dismissed by the New York Times until John Leonard became an early champion of Toni Morrison's work.
Do you think Beloved is like Ulysses, a sort of an American Ulysses?
Well, the New York Times chose it, you know, the greatest books of the past 25 years. It ranked number one. I think it holds up there. I think that
is
will
it
be
a book that people will lie about and say they have read, but maybe they haven't?
I would shudder to think that people hadn't read Beloved, you know, who said that they read Beloved. I think the way that Toni Morrison has told that story is so masterful. Mm. Once you get into that world, it's impossible to leave it.
What about the Bible? What happened to the Bible here? 24%.
Thou shalt not lie.
Yeah, exactly.
But did no one read the Ten Commandments?
Yeah, but people do all the time. And, you know, I think this is absolutely fascinating. I know as a books editor, you must be... It's at least good to know that books are still something that you lie about. People lie about their sex life all the time. Why not books?
I lie about both.
Yeah. Patrick Henry Bass, thanks so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
So we are asking people all morning here on The Takeaway to build a list of books that people always fib about reading. What book have you said you read but haven't really? And why? I mean, who are you trying to impress? I mean, there's a lot of talk about impressing dates here on The Takeaway, but maybe you were trying to impress your boss, maybe your co-host. Tell us what Cliff Notes you own at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is there actually a shortcut to reading War and Peace? And what was the book that you read 10 pages of?
Marcel Proust, Remembrance of Things Past.
Yes, yeah. That book is about 1,200 pages, something like that, 7 volumes.
Yeah.
Swan and Love.
Yeah.
I lied about it.
You lied about it.
No, I did not read that. I really did.
Did you get a date?
I did.
Uh-huh. See, these are the kinds of stories.
Go ahead.
These are the kinds of stories we're trying to share. We had Zelig at the top. Did you see the Zelig movie?
It's all about
not reading Moby
Absolutely,
Dick and feeling
yes.
awful about it.
One of Mia Farrow's better performances in a Woody Allen film.
I didn't read Moby Dick as a young man and then did later and felt much better because I didn't have to lie about it anymore.
Right, did you go back and tell your teacher?
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Mike Gill, on a Monday morning, give me an idea. What is the key to a fabulous get-up-and-go latte?
It's dropping the espresso right when you ask for it and also heating up the milk just when you ask for it.
Well, that sounds great. How long have you been in this latte game, Mike?
Well, now I've been in it 5 years.
Is it fair to say you might be a bit overqualified for this gig?
Well, I thought that originally, but then when I got my job at Starbucks, I realized I was underqualified. It's really tricky to make the right drink in the right way.
But what did you used to do?
I used to be what they called a big shot advertising guy.
So 10 years ago, you were an advertising executive at a Madison Avenue firm, and now you're at Starbucks?
Yeah, you can see me sweeping up or making the drinks and even cleaning the toilets.
Man, that's a hard luck story. That's tough, Mike. Now think back to those great days in corporate America, and I want you to tell me, what was the best thing that ever happened to you?
The best thing that ever happened to me was getting fired from my big advertising job because I was able to discover that it's a lot more fun and enjoyable to serve coffee to others than it is to sit in crazy meetings.
Mike, make my latte a triple, bud, putting a foamy top on layoffs. Reinvention for breakfast. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. We're foaming the milk on this Monday, March 9th. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'd like some soy milk, please.
You
this
got
is
it.
Farai Jadeh and for Adora Udoji, who's taking time off to be with her new baby. Coming up this hour, if you don't want to reinvent yourself like Mike did, we'll show you what the pros recommend for saving your job. Also, Northern Ireland flares up after years of peace. We'll see what's behind the new violence, all this and more ahead. But first, top headlines.
Asian markets struggling this morning. Japan's Nikkei is getting the worst of it. The benchmark is at a low not seen in more than a quarter century. President Obama will reverse the Bush administration ban on embryonic stem cell research funding this morning. We'll have a conversation to explain what's next in just a moment.
And the president's auto task force is in Detroit today. They'll meet with car execs and union leaders. They want more detail on what automakers plan to do with the nearly $40 billion in government loans GM and Chrysler want. Now, on the other hand, Ford is not seeking government loans yet, but it does want big concessions from the United Auto Workers Union. Today, the results should come in from a UAW member voting on a new deal with Ford. It should include a pay freeze and loss of some job protection.
National average gas prices rose nearly 2 cents in the latest Lundberg survey. Regular now averages $1.96 a gallon, which still feels low. Oil topped $46 a barrel in trading, driven up by anticipated OPEC production cuts. Those numbers are well below the summer highs, of course.
And Circuit City is kaput. The electronics retailer shut its doors for good on Sunday. 34,000 people out of work. Customer Ken Frumpkin said he was sad to see the chain go.
It's a real shame to see a big corporation like this go out of business. That means that there's less options for us to buy our electronics.
The chain made the call to close after going bankrupt and failing to find a buyer or a financial lifeline.
And there's 34,000 Circuit City employees who need to reinvent themselves. By the way, the markets begin at 683. That's the S&P index. Looks like it's poised for a lower open in about 30 minutes. Speaking of reinvention, more than 500,000 Americans lost their jobs last month. How did they get from where they were to where they need to be? Reinvent yourself and choose a new career on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're going to have some great reinvention stories later.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Faraya Jadeh.
Good morning.
And I know you know the answer to this, but think back. It seems like, you know, probably a half century ago. Do you know the most important Bush administration story prior to 9/11? Here's a hint.
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made. Leading scientists tell me research on these 60 lines has great promise that could lead to breakthrough therapies and cures.
As President Bush, speaking on August 10th, 2001, announcing a partial ban on stem cell research, a ban on embryonic stem cells, but proceeding with other stem cells. It's a ban that's been in force until this morning, when Barack Obama plans in an announcement at about 11:45 this morning to reverse that Bush administration doctrine, which created all kinds of impacts in the scientific research community that we're going to discuss now and also see what the impact of the reversal is going to be. Joining us is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, reporter for The New York Times. She joins us from her home in Maryland. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And Dr. George Daly, Associate Director of Stem Cell of the Stem Cell Program at Children's Hospital in Boston. He's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Daly, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
This is a twofold story, it seems to me. Cheryl, let me begin with you. Number one, it's about this reversal and this old debate over embryonic stem cells and how it got mixed up in the pro-life abortion debate in politics. But it's also a story about Obama's professed interest in removing politics from all kinds of basic science. Which is the most important this morning, do you think, Cheryl?
Well, I think the announcement that will make the biggest news and already has is the overturning of the Bush stem cell restrictions. But equally important is the president's pledge to, as he said in his inaugural address, restore science to its rightful place. And what he means by that is that he wants government to really take a clear and unbiased view of scientific information. He wants the best possible science advisors to advise his administration on a range of issues, from climate change to the Endangered Species Act to family planning matters. And this is yet another attempt to undo what he believes were the wrongs of the Bush administration.
So to depoliticize science, we begin with stem cells. Dr. George Daly, how depoliticized is it possible to be with stem cells, given that the bitter debate really is going to have repercussions even into the kinds of research that gets approved in the United States, assuming the federal government begins to fund it?
There's remarkably wide support in the American public for stem cell research. Everyone is affected, their loved ones or themselves, by disease. And stem cells represent a promising new opportunity to understand disease and treat disease. So I think that when people look through the political debate, what they see is an attempt to advance human health. And that's what the promise of stem cells offers.
This is Farai. One of the things that strikes me is someone I know actually recently was diagnosed with MS, and she's on, one of these support boards, and they are, by and large, the people on the support board, very thrilled by this change. What other kinds of diseases, I'm going to toss this to you, Dr. Daly, what kinds of diseases are really ones where people are watching this closely?
Well, the community of scientists and clinicians really believe that stem cells are a platform. They are a whole new way of approaching many, many diseases. You hear a tremendous amount about spinal cord injury, diabetes, Parkinson's, but even beyond those diseases, and there's much promise there, we're going to see the influence of stem cells across the board. It's just a major tool at our disposal, and we're going to see it having an impact in drug development, and we hope in the delivery of a new kind of medicine, that is cells as medicines.
What about anti-aging? I mean, there's so much focus on use of hormones as anti-aging and whether or not that works, what the dangers are. I'm curious if that factors into this at all.
It does. I mean, aging, we can approach as aging of us as organisms. But aging also occurs at the level of cells. And so stem cell research can indeed involve a study of aging and perhaps lead to drugs that can slow the ravages of aging at the single cell level.
Well, Dr. Daly and Cheryl, I hate to be a contrarian here, but as someone who's heard a lot of these claims about stem cell research for people with spinal cord injuries, and I am one, it seems that in some sense the Michael J. Foxes with Parkinson's doing political commercials steps us away from the central reality, and that is most of the basic science on stem cells still remains to be done, that we're quite a ways removed from actual therapies with the possible exception of Parkinson's. But in general, it's basic science we're talking about here, not therapies that can come to market within the next 5 years.
You know, John, I think that's an interesting point in the public debate over this. You know, selling the notion of basic science doesn't really appeal to Americans. So when advocates talk about stem cell research, they like to talk about treatments and cures because that's something that ordinary people can get their mind around and can get behind. Wow, if we could cure Parkinson's disease or if we could cure diabetes, wouldn't this be great? Much harder to say we really want to do basic research into the understanding of these disorders. But in fact, you're right. That's what this this order that Mr. Obama is putting forth today will allow. And, of course, you can't get to treatments and cures without doing the basic research. You have to put one foot in front of the other.
Dr. Daly, do you have a response on that, sort of the balancing line between basic research and calling for real hopeful therapies?
Yes. There is an enormous amount of basic research that needs to be done. But I want to point out that the first FDA-approved trial occurred just in the last few weeks for spinal cord injury. So indeed, there are going to be tests of embryonic stem cell-based medicines in patients with spinal cord injury. And I think that's just the first of many that you'll see. Yes, the focus now will be on basic research, and the time to get to patients will be long, and the real impact will be felt over many, many years. But we should get started now, and today is a very good day for that.
And the announcement from the Obama administration will be at 11:45 today. I'm presuming that might be one of the reasons why you're down in Washington, Dr. Daly. Is it important for the president to step away from the sort of more ideological debate on stem cells, or is it more important that the president, as commanding officer of science in America, step forward as an advocate? Which would you prefer, Dr. Daly?
Well, as a very, very thoughtful individual, I expect that he has looked at all sides of this issue and realizes that it does create challenges for some in our community. But I think he puts the emphasis on the need to advance human health, and in thinking about the many, many patients who are affected by these diseases, his announcement will indeed energize not only the scientific community, but all of those patients out there who are really looking for the hope for the future. I myself, I'm excited as a kid on Christmas morning. I woke up very early. I couldn't sleep. I think this is a great day for science and ultimately will be a great day for my patients.
And Cheryl, following up on this idea, Dr. Daly saying it's a great day for science. Is this going to produce a backlash? We have seen in, the past couple of years, debates over everything from evolution to stem cells. This is political and religious territory as well as scientific territory. Do you anticipate a debate over the expansion of science in the Obama administration?
Well, nothing happens in Washington without a fight, and no fight is as intense in Washington as anything that touches, even tangentially, on the abortion debate, and that's where this stem cell debate is. So as Dr. Daly was saying, it's a great day for science, I was thinking, yes, but it's a dark day for opponents of abortion, and they are already gearing up for a major fight over this. Not much they can do about it. President Obama has the power to do this by executive order.
Although, Cheryl, let me just add and just give me a couple of facts about this. It appears as though the big issue of actually experimenting on embryos has been punted into the Congress, right?
Well, that's exactly right. As I wrote in this morning's newspaper, I wouldn't say punted into the Congress. It is the purview of the Congress. The Congress imposes a ban on embryo experiments. It has every year since 1996. The president has no power to overturn that ban, and he's not going to take an issue on it.
And so that still remains up, and that will be subject to debate. We have to go. But for an excited doctor, George Daly, and for Cheryl Geist-Dolberg, a big story, a big headline on science today at the White House. Dr. George Daly is Associate Director of Stem Cell Programs at Children's Hospital in Boston, also at Harvard Medical School. Cheryl Geist-Dolberg is a reporter for The New York Times. Thanks to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Farai Chidea, who's filling in for Adora Udoji. And we talked with Mike Gill at the top of the hour, who went from advertising executive to latte maker at Starbucks and loves his reinvention. Well, in a climate of more than 500,000 layoffs just last month, Is it time to reinvent yourself? What do you think? What field have you never tried but always wanted to? Pottery? Opening your own coffee shop? Maybe something more recession-centric? Get into your greatest fear. If there is a layoff in your future, how would you reinvent yourself? Choose a new career at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Right?
And unemployment hit a 25-year high on Friday. Ouch! Americans are struggling. We want to focus on ways to survive. As the rate goes up, the joblessness rate, it's becoming almost commonplace for American workers to consider a plan of action in case they get laid off. I was actually traveling this weekend and met a woman in the airport who basically just started talking to me. And she was like, yeah, I'm reporting back to HQ because I'm going to be laid off. They haven't told me yet, but I know it's going to happen. It's that kind of feeling that people have, and they're usually right. So,
That's spooky.
It is. She just needed someone to talk to. And so we have with us now Callie Yost, who blogs for Fast Company magazine on the subject of work and life. She's got some vision for us. And, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating is folks assume that laying people off is cost effective. There's now some questioning of whether or not that's the only option. And tell us, you know, about those questions, and then we'll get to the specifics of, you know, how much the cost-benefit analysis is.
Well, first, I think it's important to say that in some instances, layoffs really are going to be inevitable if it's an industry that's restructuring. Yeah. But managers think that if they lay someone off who makes $50,000, they're going to save $50,000. And actually, that's not true. It's going to cost them more than that $50,000 to let someone go. And that's why the research shows that layoffs tend to be a short-term fix without a lot of long-term profit benefits. So,
well, how does that work mathematically? I mean, the person isn't coming in and they aren't getting paid. So what are the costs?
Well, the estimate is anywhere between the cost of a layoff is anywhere between 150% to 250% of a person's salary.
For that year?
Well, no, going forward.
Going forward,
because
right.
What happens is there are a lot of associated costs with a layoff that we don't take into consideration. So, for example, there's severance, there's the payout of vacation, there's outplacement services, there's benefits continuation, unemployment insurance premiums, the cost of having an exist. It goes on and on and on. So you really don't get that immediate savings. And the question then becomes, okay, so what does a manager do that faces the very real need to manage their labor costs in this recession? And the fact is there are flexible alternatives to layoffs that allow you to get the benefit of labor cost savings without all of these associated expenses related to layoffs. And that includes reducing schedules and salaries. It includes job sharing. It includes furloughs. It includes adding unpaid vacation days to the year. And it allows not only the manager to save the costs, but people to keep jobs in a time when it's a little tough to get one.
Are people willing to really take the cut? Because, you know, we've talked about this. If you're in an office of, you know, or a division of five people and one could be cut or you could each work 4 days, that's a significant nut out of your salary. Are people in general willing to take that kind of a cut versus seeing someone go?
You know, I'm finding they are.
Really?
Yeah,
so you're
I really
actually
am.
Negotiating as groups?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah, because, well, here's the first thing. Number one, it is not on the manager's radar screen to offer these flexible options. They really do go right to cuts, unfortunately, because we've lost track of a historical precedent of doing this. Back in the 80s, we did take a more flexible approach to labor cost savings. We lost it the last 20 or so years, and now it's not on their radar screen. So people go in and say, look, if you're thinking of laying me off, why don't we just all take a 10% cut in pay? Why don't we add six unpaid vacation days? We'll take a 2-week furlough. And you get pretty far into your cost savings by doing that.
Now, that sounds more likely than what occurred to me when you were talking before, is you can't lay me off. It'll bring down the company, man. That probably isn't going to be as persuasive as coming with all the workers and having a variety of flexible things to do.
Exactly.
But one of the things you talk about whole movement talks about is the administrative cost of processing the layoff, but there's also the question of team building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that when you have people who start disappearing, that it drives down morale. Does it drive down productivity?
It across the board,
right.
Morale, productivity, the willingness to stay at the company when things turn around. really, these are the costs that don't get factored in when managers think about downsizing. And they really, it's a direct bottom line hit when these things.
And is this in every sector? Or are we talking just about sort of the office kind of scene where you're talking about white collar workers? Or is this also true in the manufacturing line? Is it true in service industries as well?
Well, that 150% number is really very conservative. That is a very much on sort of the not knowledge worker. That's when you get into the 250%. And it's exactly, I know
really?
You see your face, you're surprised. Yes, because if you think about it, a knowledge worker, let's say, they're walking out the door with years and years of contacts, of knowing how to get the job done. And you know what? That is never coming back, because the next person who comes to fill that job, which is actually what happens also in layoffs, is they're hiring at the same time. Studies have shown that very rarely do you have a layoff and then there isn't rehiring. So you're not going to hire in, though, those contacts and that knowledge of how to get the job done.
So you're, if you're a high seniority, high, relatively high salary employee, your best bet to prevent a layoff is what?
To go in and say, look, here's the story. I'll take a 20% cut in pay and let me work with you to try to get this business to recover. Here's how we can work together. And then when it recovers, I'm here to hit the ground running.
Fascinating stuff, Callie. Thanks. Guest was Callie Yost, work and life blogger for Fast Company, and we have Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Today, GM and Chrysler make their case for more government loan money. They're hosting the Obama administration's auto task force. The car companies want billions more in aid, and the task force will evaluate their plans and decide whether they should have the money. The task force will also meet with top union leaders. Ford doesn't have its hands out for government money so far, but it is asking for help from the United Auto Workers Union. Today, the results should come in from the UAW member voting on a new deal with Ford. It includes a pay freeze and loss of some job protection. Gas prices are on the way up. Average national gas prices are $1.96 a gallon. That's up nearly 2 cents. And this is according to the latest Lundberg survey. Its chief predicts prices will keep rising. Oil is climbing too, at times topping around about $46 a barrel this morning. An expected OPEC production cut is pumping up the prices. And the International Monetary Fund is meeting in Africa this week, and they will look at the impact of economic troubles on the continent. Global leaders will meet in Tanzania, and right now the IMF predicts sharply slowing economic growth for sub-Saharan Africa. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
First you don't succeed, then you don't succeed.
A lot of folks are trying again, trying to find a new career. I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji on maternity leave. Now, if you are someone who has lost your job or think that you are going to lose your job, are you doing a complete redirection of your career? Maybe you're that physician's aide who always wanted to be a pastry chef. Are you going to stay in the same career? Tell us your new chosen.
That is the same career. Actually, physician's assistant and pastry chef. That's
oh,
not
yeah.
A change. Yeah, they're basically the same.
Oh, yeah, right. I think one's a little sweeter than the other.
Ooh, nice.
877-8-MY-TAKE is the phone number, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Tell us what you wanted to try, but might now.
disturbing story out of Northern Ireland over the weekend. Dissident nationalists shot dead two soldiers in a British Army barracks on Saturday night. And all of a sudden, the troubles, the so-called troubles between Northern Ireland and Britain and Ireland are all back in the news. Here's Prime Minister Gordon Brown of the UK.
No murderer will be able to derail a peace process that is the support of the vast majority of the people of Northern Ireland, and we will step up our efforts to make the peace process one that lasts and endures.
Can this latest incident provide enough repercussions and ripples to derail the peace process or at least set it back? Joining us now is Colette Hume, who's BBC correspondent in Northern Ireland. She joins us from County Antrim. Colette, first of all, what are the latest details on what we know about the incident that took place Saturday night?
Earlier this morning, we heard from the commanding officer. What had happened was this, that on Saturday evening at around 20 past 9 GMT, the local pizza place took a call from soldiers based here at the barracks. They were just hours away from going to deploy to Afghanistan, to Helmand province, and they wanted to have one last pizza with their friends before they left the barracks to catch a flight over to Afghanistan. That pizza, in fact, two pizzas, were separately delivered by guys from Domino's Pizzas at just before 10 o'clock. As they pulled up to the barracks where I'm standing talking to you now, a car which was following them came to a halt, and at least two gunmen got out, and they basically used an automatic weapon to shoot repeatedly at a group of four soldiers, and indeed, they also attacked the two pizza delivery men. Now, as we now know, two of those soldiers were killed in the attack. Two others were very, very badly injured. And just to give you an idea of the ferocity of that attack, it is now Monday morning here in Northern Ireland, and there is still a pool of blood just outside the barracks, and there are bullet holes in the walls of the sentry post. More than 40 shots were fired in total.
Oh, that's a remarkably vivid and brutal scene. A group calling itself the Real IRA claimed responsibility. Where might they have come from, and what do they represent?
Okay, well, they are a dissident group of Republicans who split from the IRA that many people will know about from their campaign of violence and terror right through the 70s to the 90s. Now, this splinter group did not want to get involved in the peace process. They didn't want to take part in the democratic process, and they split off. They're a very disorganized gang of people, but they are showing increasingly that they are able to deploy and able to carry out attacks with deadly accuracy. I think probably the attack that many people in the U.S. will perhaps remember is the Omar bombing back in 1998, when 29 people in a market town in Northern Ireland were killed, including a woman who was pregnant with twins. That was a bomb attack carried out by the Real IRA. Now, they have been known more for targeting business premises and shops and industry in the recent past, but they are changing tack. Just a few weeks ago, when I was here in Northern Ireland, the police and the security services defused a 300-pound car bomb in a place called Castlewellan, which is about 35, 40 kilometres from Belfast. And, of course, now the Real IRA, this small dissident group, have claimed responsibility for this attack, and they say they were simply attacking soldiers who, as far as they are concerned, are occupying the north of Ireland.
And Colette, does the UK, does Britain specifically have a lot of leverage in this situation, or not so much?
Has a great deal of leverage. I think there are a couple of important points to make about the fact that the Prime Minister comes here, is that he is sending out a very clear signal, first of all, that the London government is totally united with the government here in Northern Ireland in condemning these attacks. It's a show of support. And also on a very personal and intimate level, Gordon Brown here this morning met many, many members of staff here at the barracks, and indeed some of the soldiers who were involved in what happened late on Saturday night. Now, Gordon Brown will also be having a series of meetings today with the First Minister of Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party President Peter Robinson. He'll also be meeting the former IRA member Martin McGuinness, who is the Deputy First Minister here in Northern Ireland, and there'll be a series of talks about what's happened.
Reporting from the barracks that were the scene of a brutal shooting, two British soldiers gunned down by the members of the so-called Real IRA. That was BBC correspondent Colette Hume in Northern Ireland. So we've been talking about books that are classics, not because you read them, but because you lie about reading them. You actually haven't read them. For instance, this book.
if as many people actually read A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking as bought it, we would be a nation of cosmologists now. And clearly we're not. So I think that might be the most fibbed about book ever.
Nation of cosmologists or a nation of Russian historians? Check this one out.
I lied about reading Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace to try to better my chances with a certain woman I really liked. And it's a really stupid move because it always invites some follow-up questions, apparently. So War and Peace, don't play that game.
You know, people never lie about reading science fiction, do they?
You know, now that things like Watchmen are popular, you could get people lying to try to get their fanboy boyfriend, maybe.
Well, here was a response from one of our listeners on the Star Wars books.
My lie is that I read a lot of Star Wars books, and I guess the lie is that I read way more than most people would probably imagine.
Actually, we don't imagine that you read that much. And, of course, this one, don't try this at home.
For me, it would be Dante's Inferno. I'm hoping that I won't burn in hell for that one.
What books do you lie about? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. She doesn't burn in hell, but she has some burning headlines always. Femi Okay is right here.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Vice President Joe Biden heads to Brussels today. He will talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan with NATO allies. And President Obama ordered a review of policy there. U.S. and South Korean forces have begun a big military exercise amid rising tension over North Korea's preparations for what it calls a satellite launch. The North calls the annual maneuvers involving tens of thousands of troops a dangerous provocation. Sir Ted Kennedy had a belated birthday party last night at the Kennedy Center in D.C. A crowd of celebrities and politicians turned up to honor the 77-year-old senator, and President Obama led a chorus of happy birthday. Senator Kennedy received the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award last night. That's a look at your headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. Tens of thousands of American and South Korean forces have begun their annual joint military exercises in South Korea, and the North Korean authorities are making their feelings clear. They say it's a dangerous provocation. The tension between Seoul and Pyongyang that's been building since North Korea started preparing to launch a satellite is rising. Some countries say they're concerned the launch will be a long-range missile test. We've got John Sudworth, BBC correspondent in South Korea. Why are tensions so high over something that on the surface doesn't seem to be that serious?
Well, that's a very good question. These military exercises, a joint exercise between United States and South Korean troops, take place every year. They are large in scale. North Korea always complains about them, always complains that they are, in its view, a rehearsal for invasion. But the interesting question is why its complaints appear to be more serious in nature this time round. And I think we have to look to that planned satellite launch, as North Korea calls it, something that the United States and Japan and other regional governments here, though, believe will in fact be simply a cover for a long-range missile test. The governments here have been united in condemning North Korea for that. And in fact, the US and Japan have even hinted that they may shoot down that rocket launch if they believe it's necessary to do so, something that has infuriated North Korea. And I think that's why we're seeing this rise in tension now.
Well, let's go to a little bit of William Whedon, a U.S. military commander, where the maneuvers are taking place. And he says North Korea's fears are unjustified.
I can say that I honestly believe that the exercise is not designed to prepare for an attack on North Korea, but to defend the Republic of Korea from North Korean aggression.
John, do we know what, you know, when you say military exercises, what literally are we talking about?
Well, they are large in scale. They involve the air forces, the navies, as well as a large number of ground troops from both of the allies. They involve, essentially, according to the Allies, a wargaming scenario for the defence of South Korea, if that was ever necessary. I've covered these exercises before. Occasionally, the United States will bring in a large aircraft carrier, for example, and they invite the press, local journalists, as well as international journalists, to see a lot of what they're doing. And they're always very keen to stress that these exercises are defensive in nature. And they also point out, of course, that North Korea will hold its own military exercises. All armies, of course, have to practice what they do. So I think the view here in the South is that North Korea, if you like, is using this exercise as a pretext to raise tension, and partly, as I said earlier, because of its sensitivity over this planned rocket launch that it says will be a satellite, others fear otherwise.
So, John, I guess the question really is, will these exercises end with some fundamental change in the North Korean story, or is it just an escalation of tensions and we'll see where it goes?
It seems at the moment it's very unlikely that North Korea appears willing to compromise. Of course, the international community will be doing all it can to convince it not to launch that rocket, mm-hmm. and trying as many ways as possible to keep pressure on North Korea to make sure it doesn't happen.
All right, John. Thanks so much. John Sudworth, BBC correspondent in South Korea.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Thomas Edison was a legendary inventor, but who's a reinventor? There's millions of them. Find out what they're doing when we come back after Femi Okay gives us the headlines. Femi?
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Barack Obama will sign an order today ending former President George W. Bush's limits on using federal dollars for embryonic stem cell research. The President's Automobile Task Force will be in Detroit today. Task Force members will meet with top executives of GM and Chrysler, as well as union officials, and will also tour GM and Chrysler facilities. Now, do you remember this moment during the President's inauguration speech back in January?
We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers.
Now, it seems that the president was in tune with the country. A study on American religious life finds a decline in the percentage of Christians, although Christianity is still the dominant faith in the U.S. About three-quarters of Americans call themselves Christians. The survey also shows more Americans choosing no religion. That number is now at 15%.
Well, Obama wasn't saying there are fewer Christians, though, was he? He was just sort of naming.
He wasn't, no.
So
who's
the growing group there that's reducing the Christians?
It's the number of people who decide that they have no faith or no religious affiliation. But I was just playing that clip
hordes.
To you, John.
The godless hordes, I see.
So that you could actually hear the rain
of becoming like Europeans.
And no faith.
No, I understand. Oh, that's a good point. Becoming like Europeans.
Europeans,
exactly right.
Lower faith.
And that's a look at your news. Thank you very much. Back to you two.
Thank you so much, Femi.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up,
pick myself up,
dust ourselves off,
dust myself off,
and begin again the work of remaking America.
Start all over again.
First you don't succeed,
first you don't succeed.
Yeah. Dust yourself off and try again.
Reinvention. It's not just for people with parachutes anymore. Barack Obama talked about reinvention and remaking ourselves in America as the economic recession and downturn takes hold. Well, he reinvented himself. He was once a senator. Now he's the president. Well, following in the Obama footsteps, there are millions of Americans who have lost their jobs or who anticipate losing their jobs who have to get from there to here. From what I once was to what I can and will be. It's a trajectory that follows unemployment that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be laid off to think about reinventing yourself. Joining us now are Gail Ambrosius, who's a chocolatier in Madison, Wisconsin. Gail, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And in the studio, you heard his voice at the top of the hour, Mike Gill, who is an author and Starbucks employee. You used to be a creative director at an ad firm.
That's right.
You were in corporate America.
I was very much in the heart of the beast.
And in the best thing that ever happened to you, you told me at the top of the hour, was
getting fired.
Getting fired. All right. So you got to think in this way to be able to reinvent yourself. Gail, what was the best thing that ever happened to you in your career?
Getting my pink slip. I was laid off. About 5 years ago from the state of Wisconsin. I was an employee at the Department of Natural Resources, and I was a cartographer.
A map maker, right?
That's right. Right. That's right.
Now, how do you go from cartographer to chocolatier? And what were the moments when you thought to yourself, my gosh, what's an unemployed map maker going to do in Wisconsin?
Well, I kind of fell in love with the idea of making chocolate way back when I was 17. But, you know, I kind of let go of that idea because people thought, well, that's not a really good job, or you've got to get something very stable and secure like a state government job. So I went to school and I got the job, but I never let go of that idea. And when I got my pink slip, I thought, yay, here's my chance. Now I can be the chocolatier I've always wanted to be.
Now, of course, that was 5 years ago. For you, Mike, it was 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
Very different economy now.
Yes.
Do you have any words for people who are laid off and getting pink slips and maybe not jumping for joy in this economic environment?
Well, I think it is a terrible shock to be fired, especially like myself. I define myself through my job, and I burst into tears literally the day I got fired. But I think my advice would be to let that go, because it was only when I gave up my feeling of my previous self as this top advertising guy that I was able to move on in my life. And I think the key thing is to just say, okay, I'm fired, have a big cry, shake your fist at the universe, and then get on with your life, because forward motion, it works. At least for me, I found this job where I'm so much happier today than I ever was in the corporate world.
You know, Mike, this is Farai. Yeah. I've been sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's on maternity leave. Anyway, one thing that strikes me about what you just said is that it sounds awfully like some of the Buddhist teachings, that you can become overly defined with, you know, with any number of worldly things. It sounds as if you're someone who's willing to shed your skin in order to move on. But a lot of people cling to these identities that we've built up over years of work.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very you make a very wise, I think, and profound point. By the way, it took me years to get there, because but I think that's the key, which is you have to shed all those feelings of defining yourself by, you know, I was still dressing up in Brooks Brothers suits long after I was ever going to get back into that executive suite. And so it's only when I gave it up and said, okay, I'll wear a green apron and serve coffee to others and serve others, because I think what we forget in life is that we aren't our jobs. We are people who have a life. You know, in America, we always say, what do you do to people? But it's actually who you are. So look inside your own heart. That's one of my, in my book, I say one of the key things is to follow your own heart. Touch your heart and say, what do you love to do? And in my case, I love serving others and making them happy through just the simple things in life, even cleaning a toilet, rather than trying to sit in these crazy meetings I used to do.
All right, Mike, can I call you Yoda? Let's do some of the numbers here. Gail, you went from a salary of what to what you're making now, and how did you deal with that with your other responsibilities?
Oh, boy. Well, I was a single mom at the time. My son was in high school, and I've now got him into college, and I've paid for 2 years of college so far.
Whoa.
So I'm pretty proud of myself.
Not bad. For you, Mike, yeah. What do you do for people who get fired who have kids and they've got tuitions to pay?
No, it's a huge sort of traumatic shock.
I mean, you took an 80% pay cut,
yes,
right, at
yeah,
least.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I had to do was to lower my overhead just in a very simple, mundane way. You know, I used to buy these $3,000 suits. In the last 5 years, I bought one pair of khaki pants and two black shirts. And that's my overhead. Oh, the other thing is, the big surprise, John, was that by lowering my overhead, getting rid of all that stuff, I thought a big house was essential and a big lifestyle and all that stuff. I'm so much happier now. I have my dining room table is like a picnic, white plastic picnic table, $53. In other words, you adapt, and guess what? The good news is, we don't maybe need all that fancy stuff.
Well, the economy needs the economic activity, that's for sure, if you were going to believe the Treasury Secretary. Gail, is downsizing a joyful endeavor?
It's kind of scary at first, but I think you, like he said, you have to really look at what's important to you and, you know, really prioritize your life. I realized, you know, my son was my priority and he was my motivation for succeeding in my business. And it is. It's all about reinventing yourself. You know, nothing stands still. We're in a dynamic world. You have to adapt.
And your book, Mike, I should mention, is How Starbucks Saved My Life, A Son of Privilege Learns to Live Like Everyone Else. Is it true that you feel more bonded to everyone else by doing the job that you're doing at Starbucks?
That's, John, that's another big gift to me, because if I just continued in my corporate life and ended up dying, say, in that, I would have believed that, you know, I deserved all that stuff because I was so smart. And when I got in Starbucks, you know, I realized, boy, you know, I wasn't overqualified. I was almost underqualified because I met people from way different kinds of backgrounds, much, you know, who didn't have all the advantages I had with my Yale education and everything, who were way outperforming me.
Well, I hear the excitement. I totally hear the excitement in your voice. Gail, what's the best thing about your chocolate?
Well, I think it's similar. It's connecting with people. You know, I'm making this product that puts smiles on faces. You know, people buy it to celebrate joyous occasions, just to make themselves feel good. I think, you know, we all could use a little more happiness, and it's just really a pleasure to be able to deliver that.
Well, sign me up. Mac Maker to Chocolatier, Gail Ambrosius from Madison, Wisconsin, congratulations. And Mike Gill, author and Starbucks employee from ad exec to latte server. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. So reinvention stories, that is great. We're also building a list of books that people always fib about reading. What book have you said you read but haven't, really? Josh said on our website, in college I took a 3-month course on the Canterbury Tales, and I still keep the huge book on my bookshelf for bragging rights. In truth, I think I read about 10 pages of it. Thank God for Cliff Notes. Ellen chimes in, I did read several books in their original French in college, Le Rouge et le Noir, Madame Bovary, but I really didn't understand them, and of course I can't even say them in their original language. But while I can brag about my accomplishment, Ellen says, I couldn't tell you anything about those books. Was The Red and the Black about clergy? That's Stendhal. If you read the book and have forgotten nearly everything about it, does it still count as reading? Wade writes. What Cliff Notes do you own? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Your takeaway?
The question then becomes, okay, so what does a manager do that faces the very real need to manage their labor costs in this recession? And the fact is there are flexible alternatives to layoffs.
Listen to Kali Yost. Don't get laid off.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.